Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 21st of October, these are our main stories. Kurdish-led forces in Syria say they've left the strategic border town of Ras el Ain under a temporary truce with Turkey. The two Green parties in Switzerland have made historic gains in parliamentary elections. Also in this podcast, whatever members of Parliament may say, the British government maintains it'll leave the European Union next week.
If it is the case that the House of Commons backs the Prime Minister's legislation, and I believe they will, then we leave.
And why gorillas pay a heavy price for people trying to get the perfect Instagram shot. Start on the Turkish-Syrian border, where Kurdish fighters say they've withdrawn from the Syrian town of Ras el Ain. Now, the withdrawal is part of a ceasefire agreement brokered by the United States, which has pulled its own forces out of Syria. Critics say Donald Trump gave the Turkish leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, a green light to cross the border and push Kurdish fighters back about 30 kilometres. Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher is on that border. First, I asked her to explain why Ras el Ain is such a key location.
Ras el Ain is a Syrian town on the Turkish border. It's in the central part of the border, and that's one of the reasons why the Turks focused their offensive in that area, because they wanted to take the central part so they could cut off Kurdish connection between the west and the east of the border. And it's a largely Kurdish town, and the Kurdish militias had set up quite strong defenses there, including a network of tunnels, which is another reason why you're hearing so much about it, because the fighting has been very fierce there. They worked very hard to defend it.
Now, we've learned a bit more about the place that's been dominating the news for a few days. What's the latest from there? What's happened?
So the ceasefire was supposed to begin on Friday, but the Kurdish forces that were in Ras el Ain said they were still under siege and they were still coming under attack. And they had been in touch with the U.S. about it constantly, they said. And it seems now that the issue has been resolved. Convoys have gone in to take out the fighters and take out the wounded. That started on Saturday night and it was completed on Sunday. And in the meantime, Kurdish leaders had said if they were able to evacuate Ras el Ain, then they would start to withdraw from a zone on the border, which they are obliged to do under the terms of the ceasefire negotiated by the U.S. So once they withdraw from that zone, that will leave the Turks in charge of this crucial central area of the border. It will essentially consolidate the territory they gained during the offensive.
There was much fanfare made about this ceasefire, but it doesn't bear many of the hallmarks of a ceasefire so far.
Well, what it did was it stopped most of the bloodshed. There was sporadic attacks throughout this past period since the beginning of Friday. And again, there was this issue of Ras el Ain and the fighting there and the siege. But broadly speaking, it was much quieter than it had been, and people were sort of holding their lines.
And things may have been resolved to some extent in Ras el Ain, but are there other towns and cities and villages along the border which will become the next focus?
Well, if the Kurdish fighters withdraw from this area, it's between the towns of Ras el Ain and Tal Abyad. Those are two main towns. Then one assumes or one expects that there will be a certain amount of calm in that area initially. The issue is that the Turks want the whole border region as what they call a safe zone, because they want to push the Kurds back all along the border. They regard them as a terrorist threat to their national security. But the Kurds are still in control of most of those other border areas, and they have called in the Syrian forces to help them. Once the U.S. troops left, which served as their sort of protective umbrella against the Turks, they turned to the regime, even if they didn't want to, and asked the Syrians to come in and help them. The Syrians have started to deploy in that area, not broadly, not a lot, but they have started to deploy. So it's going to become complicated to see what happens to the rest of that border area and how the Syrians feel about it, and crucially, how the Russians feel about it, because they support Syria and they will have a big say in what happens. President Erdogan of Turkey is going to be meeting President Putin of Russia on Tuesday to talk about this.
Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher on the Turkish-Syria border.
Now, earlier, a long convoy had carried fighters, the wounded and civilians out of the town of Ras Al Ain, among them vehicles belonging to a relief organisation called the Free Burma Rangers, which, as the name suggests, started working in conflict areas of Burma or Myanmar, but now also operates in the Middle East. Its director, Dave Eubank, a former US Special Forces officer and missionary, gave my colleague James Menendez an account of how his group had helped people to get out.
We went in and loaded up everyone we could, and then we drove out, and it was more shooting. But again, I think this was just trying to scare us, or I don't know what, but nothing to stop us.
And how many people in total do you think you've managed to get out then?
Well, civilians, about 50, and wounded, 15 to 20. And then there were many other people that came out that the Syrian Democratic Forces probably could speak better to who all they were. But we basically got everybody out of there.
But broadly, a mixture of, what, fighters and civilians?
Right.
And how difficult was it to convince people, civilians, that they had to go? I mean, to leave their homes?
They were desperate to leave. They knew that when this ceasefire is over, and if you already heard Erdogan said, we're going to smash their heads. And so everybody was ready to go.
And where are they going to go now?
Well, they're headed towards Hasaka. And after that, I don't know. Unless someone intervenes and stops the Free Syrian Army, there's going to be many more displaced.
Because the point is, Turkey made it clear that it just wants to get rid of Kurdish fighters, Syrian Kurdish fighters from that area. It's quarrels not with civilians, but from what you're saying, civilians are going anyway because they don't believe it. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. The civilians, the civilian Kurds, this is the majority Kurdish area up along this border. They feel they will be killed or tormented or tortured or whatever. So none of these people feel they can stay.
And what's people's attitudes to what the United States has done? Do they blame the U.S. for pulling out, for precipitating all this?
Yes. They say that the U.S. betrayed them and lied to them. And I agree. I'm an American. We betrayed them and we lied to them. And that really hurts. In fact, today, I just found myself, choked up and crying three different times. It was a huge moral failure. And then, of course, you have the strategic mistake of stepping aside to let ISIS come up, others come in, Assad come back. I mean, we have allowed, of course, the U.S. is not to blame for these attacks directly. That's the choice of the Free Syrian Army and the Turks and Assad. But we had the ability to stop it, and we said we would, and we didn't. And so I've spent my whole time here. Every time I meet someone, I apologize and say, we were wrong. I don't know how we can do to change it, but everything we see, we're telling to our friends in the administration, in the U.S. government, to churches, to please change this terrible policy. And even though it's too late to get some places back, it's not too late to draw another line and say, we're going to stand with you and work this out together. I want to finish with this. The United States and the coalition cannot solve the problems here. But our presence creates a space where Kurds and Arabs can work together and maybe solve a problem. But when you step out, I guarantee you won't. It's going to be a wreck and chaos, which it is right now.
Dave Eubank with James Menendez. Now to Switzerland, where, as we record this podcast, votes are being counted in the country's parliamentary election. With partial results now in, it's clear the two Green parties have made historic gains, denting the traditional dominance of the right-wing Swiss People's Party. But why? A question for our correspondent in Bern, Imogen Folks.
I think in Switzerland you only need to lift your eyes to the hills, if you like, and you will see the effects of climate change. We have melting alpine glaciers. We have increased mud and rock slides in mountain communities. And of course, right around the world, the concerns about climate change are growing. But here in Switzerland, you get the impression it feels much more immediate. There have been climate strikes all year long, huge demonstrations. And today, voters took those concerns to the ballot box.
Climate change, I think, is pretty obvious that it's the most important topic of all in our time and age.
For me, nature preservation is very important, and the last parliament was not that brilliant in this direction.
So yeah, the Green Liberal Party, I like them because for them the environment is very important, and it's important for me as well.
And Imogen, when the environment has been such a big part of the election debate, will policies in that area change whoever wins?
I think they will. I mean, let's remember that in Switzerland, no party, because of the system, no party is ever going to get some vast parliamentary majority where they can outvote everyone else. But the two Green parties together now have over 40 seats in Parliament. That is a big force to be reckoned with. The Swiss People's Party will stay, the right-wing Swiss People's Party, so successful for so long, will stay the largest party, but they only have 54. So we're looking at the Green Party, the Green Liberals, the Social Democrats. They together are going to be a big force. Now, all of them have very strong environmental policies in their manifestos. And I think it being the Swiss way, they will all have to work together. But the way the vote has turned out will be a wake-up call for the parties who said, oh, we're not really going to put anything about climate change in our manifesto. Voters have punished the Swiss People's Party for this and not responded to their traditional campaign issues of anti-immigration, anti-European Union. None of that really featured in the campaign. Climate change was the big thing. Voters will expect proper policies now.
Our correspondent, Imogen Folkes. You're listening to Global News from the BBC World Service. Still to come.
Since the end of the Civil War, it's been the same thing. It's been politics, corruption, stealing the people's money. So this is a bit too late, actually.
Hundreds of thousands take to the streets of Lebanon to voice their frustration. Now, the Sunday political talk shows here in Britain have featured a string of government ministers vowing to lead the country out of the European Union next week. Among them, Michael Gove.
The decisions are in the hands of MPs, in the hands of the House of Commons. If it is the case that the House of Commons backs the Prime Minister's legislation, and I believe they will, then we leave.
And that's despite MPs voting for further delay and forcing the Prime Minister Boris Johnson to request an extension from other EU leaders. Later on Monday, MPs could be given another chance to back the Brexit deal agreed between Britain and the EU 3 days ago. There are also rumours of what the response to that extension request might be. So, will MPs get another chance to vote? A question for our political correspondent, Jonathan Blake.
It doesn't look likely. The expectation at Westminster is that the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, will not allow the government to hold another straight yes or no vote on Boris Johnson's deal. Why? Well, they've already been asked that question once, and it's the convention in the Commons, really, that MPs can't keep voting for the same thing just because the government or whoever's put forward the motion doesn't like the result. And also that if they were to approve the deal, it would override Saturday's decision to withhold their support for Boris Johnson's deal until the legislation implementing it had passed all the parliamentary hurdles. So it doesn't look like the government is going to get its way there.
So the legislation will now be introduced, which will give MPs not only a chance to vote yes or no to the deal, but also to introduce any number of changes to it.
That's right. This is the detailed process whereby the government brings forward the legislation, as you say, which implements Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. It puts it into UK law, and that has to happen before the UK can leave the European Union with that deal in place. But as well as an opportunity for Parliament to give its approval, it's also, as you say, an opportunity for MPs on all sides to bend and shape that legislation to their will. So those who want the UK to stay in a closer economic relationship with the EU in future will probably put down amendments to try and keep the UK in the EU's customs union. We'll also see amendments trying to put this deal to another public vote to hold a further referendum on the terms of the deal. Neither of those things the government wants, so it will be very difficult for it, I think, to see this legislation through speedily and swiftly without MPs frustrating the process again and trying to get the form of Brexit that they want. And a reminder that the timetable is already incredibly tight, with just 10 days now until the current deadline.
our political correspondent Jonathan Blake. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of Beirut and other Lebanese cities on Sunday in the biggest display yet of popular frustration with the country's looming economic collapse and perceived government corruption. There have been reports the government has agreed to abandon planned new taxes and to cut the salaries of some senior officials. Martin Patience joined the crowds in downtown Beirut.
Well, it's an extraordinary scene in the heart of Beirut. Thousands of protesters here waving Lebanese flags, and in front of them are rolls of razor wire. Beyond it is a line of riot police, and then on the hill, the Prime Minister's offices. That's the focus of this protest. The people here want the government to quit.
We want to know where our money goes. They're imposing taxes on us. However, there are no services that are provided by those taxes that are imposed. Anywhere you go in Europe, you go to the US, you have taxes, but you have transportation. You have people that can go to hospitals without paying. We don't have anything in here.
Why did you bring along your kids today?
Well, basically, we wanted to teach them what's going on in the country, and they have an idea about the fact that we're suffering, we've got issues, and something needs to be done. So they're being initiated into small revolutionary people.
And what do you make of what's going on?
Well, I think it's it should have happened much sooner. We've been, since the end of the Civil War, it's been the same thing. It's been politics, corruption, stealing the people's money. So this is a bit too late, actually.
What's striking here is that the protests are taking place across the country. And people here are insisting that they're Lebanese first. This is a country that's been plagued by sectarian politics. The Sunni bloc, the Shia bloc, the Christian bloc. Well, the protesters here are saying, enough's enough. We need to change the way we do politics in Lebanon. No more divide and conquer.
Lebanese people, for the first time in ages now, they are behaving and acting like citizens and not like people belonging to religious communities. We have to keep on taking the streets, taking back the streets, so that until we get the resignation of the government.
Then what?
Well, I think we have to be realistic. We are dealing with people who have been in power for 40 years. They have the money, they have the weapons, they have the media, unfortunately, too. But what we want, actually, is now a small technocrat government to try to solve the crisis. We are in a big political and economic crisis. We need new blood to be able to handle the new pressure on Lebanon on all levels.
The Prime Minister has given his cabinet until Monday to come up with reforms. Most people here aren't expecting very much. They say that the system needs to be completely overhauled, that the old faces that have dominated Lebanese politics for 30 years has to come to an end. But the politicians who profited so much from this system aren't going to go without a fight.
Martin Patience in Beirut. The Portuguese capital, Lisbon, has undergone a radical transformation in recent years. Once a cheap, relatively low-key city, it's become a magnet for tourists, investors, even celebrities. The socialist-run City Hall touts Lisbon as a vibrant, cosmopolitan place which reflects the country's remarkable recovery from its chronic economic crisis. Not everyone's happy about its newfound status, though, as our reporter Guy Hedgeco has been finding out. This is your
a song from Madonna's latest album, Madame X, which was inspired by Lisbon, her home since 2017. Since moving there, she has repeatedly sung the city's praises.
Because Lisbon is a melting pot of cultures musically, from Angola to Guinea-Bissau to Spain to Brazil.
But Madonna's not the only celebrity who has discovered the Portuguese capital. Hollywood stars Monica Bellucci, John Malkovich and Scarlett Johansson have all bought property there. And Lisbon's newfound hipness is drawing tourists, 4.5 million each year, almost double the figure of a decade ago. To cater for them, tourist accommodation firms have increased their presence, making Lisbon the city with the highest density of Airbnb properties in Europe. Housing prices, meanwhile, have soared.
I'm in the Praça do Comércio, the huge square on the edge of the Tagus River and in the heart of Lisbon's most touristy area. And I'm on my way to meet Karina Carvalho, who used to live in this area until a few months ago, when she had to move to another part of the city because her landlady wouldn't renew the rental contract on her apartment.
Every time you go and have dinner with your group of friends, someone is talking about housing problems. There are families that struggle to find an apartment they can afford.
Karina paid 500 euros per month in rental for her apartment here, but she thinks that her former landlady has now turned it into tourist accommodation and could charge up to 1,500 euros per month.
Housing is the key factor for happiness for many people. And in Lisbon, it seems that we simply don't care.
But locals are now fighting back against Lisbon's gentrification. At this recent demonstration, protesters denounced housing prices, inequality, and the ease with which wealthy individuals and companies are buying up property.
I'm Maria Leonor Duarte, and I belong to the platform Morar em Lisboa. We are fighting for public housing in Portugal. Okay, this is an emergency. The situation is getting worse and worse. It's impossible to ignore the voice of the citizens.
Down by the riverside, a guitarist is playing for tourists who have come to visit the city. Now, there are some reports that Madonna is planning to leave Lisbon. But even if she does, it seems that for the moment at least, the tourists will keep coming and the property prices will keep rising. And while the people of Lisbon will disagree on whether that is a good thing or not, everyone seems to agree that the city is changing fast.
Guy Hedgeco in Lisbon. The Indonesian president, Joko Widodo, has been sworn in for a second term of office. He was comfortably re-elected in April, but there's less optimism around than there was when he first came to power in 2014. Michael Bristow reports now on the challenges facing Mr. Widodo the second time around.
Demi Allah, saya bersumpah.
Joko Widodo, known as Jokowi, took his oath in front of an audience that included regional leaders.
President Republic Indonesia.
In a speech afterwards, he said he'd help eradicate poverty, improve education and keep investing in infrastructure. The economy is expected to grow by around 5% in each of the next few years, so the president can expect to fill at least some of those promises. But some Indonesians are worried about the direction their country's taking. They fear it's becoming less liberal and less free. Jokowi's new vice president is a conservative Muslim cleric. And last month there were protests against a raft of proposed new laws, one of which would have banned unmarried couples living together. Others think Indonesia's national corruption agency has been undermined and worry about the emergence of nepotism. Dozens of members of Indonesia's new parliament are related to political figures already in power. 2 decades after the fall of the authoritarian leader Suharto, Indonesians are still divided about what kind of country they want to live in.
Michael Bristow reporting. Now, don't let gorillas pay the price for your perfect Instagram shot. That's the warning scientists are giving to tourists who get too close to the animals and then risk giving them deadly diseases. More from Anna Aslam.
In the last few years, there's been a sort of spike in the number of disease outbreaks within gorillas. And this common sort of, you know, human coughs and colds, things that would take you and me out of work for a couple days. But it's led to deaths and sort of serious problems within the gorilla population. And experts believe that selfies might be part of the problem. So, I mean, they're already an endangered species. They live in sort of Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And at last count, there were only about 1,000 of them. Now, in all 3 countries, for conservation efforts, they run treks where you can go in, you can see them, you can take pictures. As long as you're 7 meters away from them and in the DRC, you're wearing face masks. Those are the rules. So a team of scientists led by Gaspard Van Ham from Oxford Brookes University looked through Instagram about 650 pictures from these treks, and they saw that in nearly all of them, people were way too close. The majority of people weren't wearing face masks. And in 20 of them, they were actually touching the gorillas, which is quite a feat. And, you know, the idea is, yes, these make better pictures, but there's a real concern that it's damaging gorillas because their post-mortems are showing that they're dying of human viruses.
Now, obviously, tourists will want to have photographs taken with all sorts of different animals. Are lots of species affected, or is it particularly gorillas?
Well, no, sadly, there are quite a few examples. So in New Zealand, for example, blue penguins are often stopped on the beach and people take pictures of them, but that means that they can't go and feed their chicks. And there was real concern that they wouldn't be able to survive infancy. And also just, you know, drugged tigers being cuddled or sloths being hugged. There's been a lot of concern by animal welfare charities that people can continue to take selfies as long as they're not threatening welfare, even if it means fewer Instagram likes.
Anna Aslam reporting. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the stories we included, do drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.